In the medical schools of this country, there is still a cycle of stories regarding Dr. Abernathy, a celebrated Scots physician of the 19th century. One of the stories about Dr. Abernathy is that one day he was called to treat a man who had been injured slightly in a carriage accident, but who was confined to his bed because he was convinced that he was dead. So Dr. Abernathy, following his usual procedure, tried to reason with the man when he found that the man was in all other respects uninjured. And finally, he thought of using an effective argument. He said to the man, "Now, sir, you are aware, are you not, that when death supervenes, the heart ceases to beat?" "Yes," said the man, "that's right." "And when the heart ceases to beat, the blood is not pumped through the arteries and veins of the body." "Yes," said the man, "that's right." "Therefore, of course, as we all know, a corpse does not bleed." "Yes," said the man, "that's right." "All right," said Dr. Abernathy, "now watch." He took his lancet, he lanced a small vein on the man's arm, and the blood spurted out. The man looked at it for a moment, looked up, and he said, "Dr. Abernathy, you and I have made a great medical discovery. Dead men do bleed." That is a story from the middle of the 19th century, but if we are to discuss liberal intellectuals, we'll have to go back a little farther than that. That was not the beginning. I have been asked to discuss with you tonight that grave social and biological problem that is presented by that noisy little band of persons who currently call themselves liberal intellectuals. It is not a new problem. The contemporary specimens have inherited the whole of their little stock of phrases and notions, which they are pleased to call ideas, from their predecessors of the 18th century, when they called themselves philosophes, since France was the country in which they were then making the most noise. But they represent a biological tendency that you can trace back historically until you see that it is much older than civilization itself. But there may be no misunderstanding. Let me make it clear that tonight I shall consistently use the word intellectual within quotation marks as the designation that a group of persons have given themselves. I shall not use the word as a common noun with its correct English meaning. If we use the word in that sense, we could do little more than agree with Ayn Rand, who, in a recent book, says quite bluntly, "Our present state of cultural disintegration is not maintained and prolonged by intellectuals as such, but by the fact that we haven't any. The majority of those who pose as intellectuals today are frightened zombies, posturing in a vacuum of their own making. The key to their souls is their longing for the effortless, irresponsible, automatic consciousness of an animal. They dread the necessity, the risk, and the responsibility of rational cognition." So tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we shall talk about, quote, intellectuals, unquote. The problem, however, is particularly urgent today. It concerns all of us because, as we all know, the communist takeover of the United States, now in progress, would have been impossible had not the self-styled intellectuals done so much of the conspiracy's work for it. But Bolshevism is a subject that we cannot consider tonight, for I must limit myself strictly to liberal intellectuals, as distinct from members of the international communist conspiracy, although I admit that in many cases it's very difficult to tell the difference. We must all cope with intellectuals every day, but I particularly hope that the suggestions that I am going to offer may be useful to some members of this audience if they belong to the class that is most besieged and harassed. One of the chief reasons why I permit myself to hope that our nation may yet survive and have a future is the fact that among the hordes that swarm over college campuses these days, there is a considerable number, even a large number, of students. Amid many obstacles and difficulties, they are trying to ascertain for themselves the nature of the world in which we live. Every large campus, of course, also has its rabble of young liberals who are forever making a din as they demonstrate for world peace, civil rights, and the like. And who, if we may judge from their appearance and their yammering, are as afraid of war as they are of soap. I'm sure that every college student here present fully understands the importance of staying on the good side of the young intellectuals. I mean, the windward side, of course. But the student's real difficulty arises from the fact that the liberal intellectuals, by methods described in two books published by the Veritas Foundation, that is, Keynes at Harvard and The Great Deceit, have attained a stranglehold on American education at the college level, and very few college students can escape the ministrations of the liberal professor who urges or requires them to follow him down the rabbit hole or behind the looking glass into the wonderland in which intellectuals live. A land in which the hapless student must emulate the White Queen, who, you'll remember, was able with just a little practice to believe six impossible things before breakfast every morning. Now, a serious examination of the problem of liberal intellectuals must, I believe, begin with recognition of one fundamental fact, that we are dealing with a phenomenon that is known in biology as symbiosis. In other words, we are examining not one species, but two that are interdependent, just as in the example of symbiosis that will come to everyone's mind. Many species of ants maintain aphids in their nests, and in such an arrangement, the ants could not live without the aphids, nor the aphids without the ants. As I have said, I consider this symbiosis as a fundamental fact in our problem tonight. So let me illustrate it with two or three examples that will make it clear. In the second half of the 19th century lived a distinguished French mathematician, Professor Michel Chalin. He was the author of a number of treatises that you will find cited in any recently complete work on geometrical theory, porisms, or conic sections. He developed a method of analytical geometry independent of the calculus, and his treatise on the displacement of solids is still regarded as a mathematical classic. He was a member of the French Academy of Sciences, which means that he was recognized as one of the 66 best scientific minds in all France. And furthermore, he was the recipient of the highest honor that the Royal Society of London could bestow. Now, Professor Chalin was quite wealthy. In One day there came to him an enterprising young intellectual named Graham Lucas, who was, he said, a specialist in finding old documents, particularly autographs. He sold the good professor an original letter, which proved that Descartes had anticipated all the discoveries of Newton. Professor Schaller was elated to be the possessor of a document of such vast significance in the history of science, and his appetite was whetted for more. So he made Bram Lucas promise to bring him all his sensational finds. And Bram Lucas did. He supplied remarkable documents, first one at a time, then by the dozen, and then by the score. In a few years, Professor Chalet had a much smaller balance at his banker's, but he owned a collection of treasures unmatched in the world. Unique documents, almost all of them autographs, written by the great figures of history. He had original letters by Pascal, by Montaigne, by Amerigo Vespucci, by Charlemagne, by Saint Jerome, by Plato, by Socrates, and by many others. It would be hard to say which item in this collection of more than 600 letters was the most remarkable, but my favorite is the autographic love letter written by Cleopatra to Julius Caesar. It was a letter that Cleopatra wrote with her own fair hand, with a steel pen, on rag paper in 16th century French. Now, it may not be fair to single out the French mathematician from among the many men like him, but just the same, if I had anything to do with running a college, I would see to it that a statue of Professor Schaller stood at the gates as a reminder of what education can do for a man. Now, if you ask which was the intellectual, Professor Schaller or Bram Lucas, the answer, of course, is both of them. They are complementary types, like the yin and the yang in the Chinese monogram. And one could scarcely exist without the other. One, indeed, is to a large extent the cause of the other. Our race always has been, and probably always will be, afflicted with well-meaning people, often well-educated and sometimes brilliant, who simply cannot keep their imaginations under control. They are born to be the dupes of any scoundrel or adventurer who takes the trouble to put out a little bait for them. Many of you, I am sure, have read the memoirs of Casanova, who was an intellectual in his day. He wrote a utopia, the Ecosomeron, in which he shows how easy it would be for us to have one world chock full of social justice. If you have read the memoirs, you will recall the once celebrated Madame d'Urfey, who was not the object of one of Casanova's rather commonplace seductions, but instead the principal source of his income for a large part of his career. Madame d'Urfey, whom Casanova met when she was fairly well along in years, was one of the wealthiest and most brilliant women in France. She was not only learned in the usual sense, but she was a chemist of some skill. She had installed an elaborate laboratory in her home, and she is credited with the invention of a laboratory furnace, which would automatically maintain a relatively constant temperature for many days. If you will remember that, of course, there was no such thing as an electric thermostat, and that the fuel had to be either charcoal or powdered coal, you will see that that must have been a device of some ingenuity. Now, Casanova who is skilled in Kabbalistic hocus-pocus, admits quite frankly that he set out to delude Madame Durfee, justifying himself, you will remember, with a plea that if he hadn't fleeced the old fool, someone else would have got her money. I think he's telling the truth when he tells us that Madame Durfee herself dreamed up the project for which she lavished so much money on him and which involved him in a whole series of ludicrous adventures. Madame Durfee was tired of being a woman, and she wanted Casanova to make a man of her. She firmly believed that that was possible because she had the same superstitious faith in the wonders of science that we see among our contemporaries. And of course, she eventually killed herself with an overdose of a drug that was intended to hasten the wondrous transformation. We may think her a fool for having believed that, but was it, after all, much more fantastic, much more contrary to the ascertained and obvious facts of nature, much more irrational than the tommy rot about noble savages, brotherhood, equality, world courts, and the like, that some of her contemporaries, Rousseau, Helvetius, Saint-Pierre, and their kind, were busily peddling to persons as credulous as she. If Madame Durfee in the 18th century seems a little remote to you, let me give you another example, which will incidentally show how closely that period is linked to the present. When I was in my teens, I knew an amiable lady who was a graduate of one of the best-known women's colleges, and at the time that I knew her, the director of a small library. She was, on the whole, well-educated and quite rational, although from time to time her eyes would take on the glazed look that is typical of liberals when they chatter about the unity of mankind, world peace, and similar pish-posh. I was really taken aback one day when she confided in me that she was a member of an international order of big-brained females headed by the Comte de Saint-Germain, who she assured me was still alive and directed the order from his chateau in Hungary, where he spent his time thinking big thoughts. Let me remind you who the famous Comte de Saint-Germain was. Of course, his name was not Saint-Germain, and he was not a count. His real identity is unknown. What little can be discovered of his back trail leads to Poland, Germany, and Portugal. But it is not known in which country he was born. Neither is it known precisely what his racket was. For unlike Casanova, he was not an ordinary swindler. One theory is that he was an espionage agent at the pay of Catherine the Great of Russia. At all events, he was supplied with evidently unlimited funds from some mysterious source. And when he turned up in Paris in 1748 as the Comte de Saint-Germain, he quickly became one of the most influential men in France, soon came to reside in the royal palace, became an advisor to Louis XV, and the darling of all the intellectuals. He had many charms. He was, for example, the perfect dinner guest. For one thing, he never ate anything at dinner. He had, you see, made a great scientific discovery, and he extracted the vital essence of life directly from the atmosphere. For another thing, he was such an interesting conversationalist. He could, for example, tell you all about the crucifixion of Christ, at which he had been present. He was, you see, 2,000 years old, and he explained that he was so well preserved for his age because, in addition to living on the air, he took every 20 years a spoonful of a colorless liquid that rejuvenated him for 20 years. Of course, the intellectuals had no difficulty in believing such things. The Comte de Saint-Germain had quite a career. But finally, in 1784, presumably at the ripe old age of 2,000 plus, he died and was buried in Schleswig. So you will see why I was a little startled when the lady told me that her society was headed by an individual who for 150 years had been in the good earth of Schleswig, sprouting, well, not sprouting daisies, I'm sure, but perhaps poison ivy. So I ventured to suggest that the Comte de Saint-Germain was probably in no condition to think big thoughts. The lady was most indignant at my crass skepticism and proceeded to prove me wrong. Members of her society had the great privilege of sending $100 to the Count in Hungary and receiving in return a personal letter of advice concerning the care and feeding of their souls. She sent the $100, which of course was the equivalent of $500 today, and she had the letter. It was, as I remember, about 25 pages long. It had been produced by a process similar to mimeographing, with blank spaces on the first and last pages in which the name of the addressee was inserted with a matching typewriter. The contents of the letter were, as one would expect, the old drivel about awakening higher consciousness and the sky pie that would be available to everyone just as soon as everyone got in tune with the infinite. But the envelope bore an Hungarian postmark, and the letter was signed, right there in ink, Comte de Saint-Germain. And that, you see, proved it. The old boy was still going strong, and presumably good for another 2,000 years at least. I don't know whether the good lady's secret society of superminds is still operating, but there are plenty like it. In 1943, for example, a committee of the California legislature stumbled on a weird organization called Mankind United, which supported an even more wonderful subsidiary called the Universal Institute for Universal Research and Administration. Now, Mankind United had the usual noble purposes. It was working for, quote, the Brotherhood of Man, equal living conditions for all peoples, equality of all races and creeds, world government, and world peace, all terms quoted from their, quote, literature, unquote. Mankind United was working desperately to save the human race from annihilation by a horrible new instrument of warfare that could exterminate 1 billion people in the twinkling of an eye. And to cap it all, Mankind United was going to conduct a, quote, crusade against poverty, unquote. In other words, you see, Mankind United put out all the stale old sucker bait that attracts do-gooders as infallibly as cheese brings a mouse to a trap. Mice never learn, of course, but then mice, so far as I know, never call themselves intellectual either. Mankind United was remarkable in other ways. According to its official report, it had a membership of 176 million men and women. Yes, 176 million. But remember that that is their figure, not mine. In addition to this large human membership, Mankind United, through the Universal Institute for Universal Research, had enlisted the cooperation of a race of little men with metal heads who live in the hollow center of the earth and produce earthquakes whenever they feel like shaking things up a bit on the surface. The identifiable head of this great society was known to the faithful as the voice. He modestly claimed that he floated around the earth just by thinking himself wherever he wanted to be. Thus he could make it from an ocean liner in mid-Atlantic to San Francisco in just 7 minutes flat. Incidentally, thinking his luggage through space along with himself to avoid delay at the customs. When the voice was located in a luxurious apartment in San Francisco, he gave the name of Arthur Lober Bell, but added that he had so many names he couldn't quite be sure which was the right one. On oath before the California Committee on Un-American Activities, he swore that he wasn't all there. You see, his organization had so much business in so many parts of the world that he just had to be in several places at the same time. Obviously, therefore, he couldn't be in any one place, all of him, at any one time. Perfectly logical. Can't dispute that. The California Committee was able to locate only a few thousand of Mankind United's 176 billion members. But here is the really significant thing. The membership included a very considerable number of college professors, teachers, physicians, lawyers, and other individuals who had been certified as literate by what are politely called institutions of higher learning. One of the most dedicated members was a full professor at the University of California, who had evidently resolved to devote his life to promoting one world through Mankind United, in cooperation, of course, with the great race of little men with metal heads downstairs. He doubtless reasoned that if these little men had metal heads, they doubtless had ball bearings in them. That would make a perfect thinking machine. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I have not mentioned these four examples out of the many hundreds that could be cited merely to amuse you. I intended them to illustrate the principle of symbiosis. The phenomenon that is called liberal intellectualism depends on the conjunction of two distinct species, the intellectual sucker and the intellectual shyster. Of course, in all societies, there is a copious supply of both species. The late P.T. Barnum used to utter the philosophic dictum that a sucker was born every minute. But as we all know, since Barnum's day, the birth rate has increased enormously. The symbiosis, as I have said, antedates civilization and all recorded history. Dr. Harry Wright, in his recent anthropological study of witchcraft among the lower forms of human life today, made a sagacious and telling observation. He studied the operations of the shamans, fetish men, and witch doctors among the subhumans who now revel on your money in the big glass cage in New York City that is called the United Nations. The witch doctors, as you would expect, are brutish things. They make themselves impressive by smearing themselves with elephant dung or by wearing a human shin bone in their knotted and greasy hair. They are stupid, but not quite so stupid as the savages among whom they flourish. A typical operation witnessed by Dr. Wright is this. A savage who thinks that he has an ache or something like that comes to the witch doctor, who, after collecting his fee in advance, applies his mouth to the affected part and sucks out the evil spirit, which he then visibly spits out in the form of dead grasshoppers, slivers of wood, or something like that. Now, of course, the witch doctor places those oddments in his mouth before beginning the ceremony and must therefore know what he is doing. Therefore, says Dr. Wright, in relation to the society in which he lives, The witch doctor is, quote, an intellectual living by his wits. Incidentally, we probably should not be supercilious about the ignorant savages who are swindled with dead grasshoppers. Not long ago, the malodorous Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, which siphons $5 billion from the pockets of the American serfs every year, used some of that money to send one of its specialists to Africa to scatter the blossoms of mental health among the fuzzy wuzzies. This expert held a degree of Doctor of Philosophy from a reputed American university, and he was a practitioner of one of our most lucrative forms of mumbo jumbo, the kind invented by Sigmund Freud. Now, the only thing that is remarkable about that is that the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare was so indiscreet as to print in its official publication, entitled Public Health Reports, a report from its expert head shrinker out in the Sudan, in which that expert boasted that he was working in harmonious cooperation with the local witch doctors, and that he and they were having fun referring patients back and forth. Why not? They were all running the same kind of racket. But now, let's return from this digression to the four random examples of symbiosis I gave you a few minutes ago. You noted, I'm sure, that lucrative swindles covering two centuries in time used the same kind of sucker bait to trap educated nincompoops. That immediately raises the question of how it is possible for such antiquated frauds to be peddled even in academic communities, which still contain a considerable number of scholars, men who, defying the precepts and examples set by John Dewey and his kind, still believe in truth and intellectual integrity. The answer, of course, is the vast power that the intellectuals have attained and ruthlessly exert. Consider for a moment a typical example. 8 or 9 years ago, an American scholar, Mathurin Dondo, wrote on the basis of a great deal of research in the French archives a biography of Henri de Saint-Simon, who is generally regarded as the founder of modern socialism. Now, Professor Dondo conscientiously and accurately reported the evidence, and he shows us what kind of man Saint-Simon was. He was, to put it briefly, a pathological liar. He seems never to have told the truth about anything when he could possibly avoid it. He was an unprincipled opportunist who lived under every government in France from the Ancien Regime to the Restoration. More agile in conscience than the Vicar of Bray, he proclaimed that each new government was the realization of his long-cherished ideals. And he went on proclaiming it so long as he had a prospect of getting regular handouts from the Treasury. He was a debauchee, given to abuse of alcohol, narcotics, and women. And while we may pardon men for almost any sensuality, our stomachs must turn at the hypocrite who makes his vices odious by claiming that his debauches are the result of a high-minded urge to do sociological research. Saint-Simon was from the first either a conscious fraud or subject to hallucinations, for he used to go into dark rooms and hold long conversations with Charlemagne, who was, he said, his ancestor. Saint-Simon had wonderful revelations in the dark room, reporting, among other things, that Charlemagne's ghost was simply tickled to death that his lineal descendant, Saint-Simon, was the greatest philosopher in the world. Saint-Simon was also a resourceful man with a fine sense of social values. After he had talked a wealthy businessman into endowing him with an annual pension, he went on to seduce or compromise that man's wife and so increase his income by levying secret blackmail on her. Now, all this and more, Professor Dundor reports in his book. But at this point, he comes up against the pet superstitions of our contemporary intellectuals. 450 years ago, Saint-Simon, while extracting fast bucks from bulbs, no, pardon me, I meant fast francs from humanitarians, put out a lot of bunk that is still fashionable stock in trade. He denounced colonialism and said that it was the duty of prosperous nations to provide technical and financial assistance to underdeveloped countries so as to industrialize the whole world and make everyone as happy as larks. He proved how awfully simple it was to abolish poverty everywhere by applying science to the twin problems of raising everyone's standard of living and organizing social justice to ensure world peace. He proved conclusively that by the year 1814, modern weapons had become so destructive that war was unthinkable. And he was a vociferous apostle of a United Nations to replace war with world cooperation. This stale old nonsense, of course, is still the stock in trade of the liberal establishment, which hasn't had a new idea, just as it hasn't learned anything, in 150 years. So what is the biographer of Saint-Simon to do? I quote verbatim from Professor Dondo's conclusion. Saint-Simon, profligate, impulsive, irrational, a plaything of his sensuous whims, victim of his delusions, belonged to the class of eccentric, unbalanced, unstable individuals from whom are recruited poets, reformers, founders of religion. The world's salvation comes from the Saint-Simons. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. You have a serious scholar, who I suspect knows better, telling you by implication that ethical responsibility and simple honesty, reason, and even the ability to distinguish between reality and hallucination are merely the trammels of earthbound mortals, petty standards that must not be applied to anyone who is contracted or says that he is contracted a sanctifying itch to save the world. You have a responsible scholar telling you expressly that the world's salvation comes from whims, irrationality, and delusions. You have also, of course, an open confession of the intellectual bankruptcy of so-called liberalism. It's hard to take the peddlers of such trumpery seriously, so long as one regards them as the merchants of ideas. Intellectuals such as Madame d'Urfey, Casanova, even Saint-Simon, seem on the whole harmless. We may even feel grateful to them for supplying us with many of the funniest true stories in the world. If it were merely a question of ideas, we could afford to sit back and laugh at the motley caravan of freaks and charlatans that has been touring our world for two centuries and relieving the yokels of their pocket money. If it were merely a question of ideas, such mountebanks could not have seriously disturbed the order and stability of the Western world. If they had to depend on the plausibility of what they say, and if they were not supported by other and stronger forces, I am quite sure that you would not find them today at work inventing, say, new teaching methods or making discoveries in social science. You would find them doing the work for which nature has fitted them. That is to say, out peddling snake oil in the Styx or operating shell games in itinerant carnivals. Some, of course, might be sufficiently courageous to become pickpockets. So obviously we must look beyond ideas to discover what has made the self-styled intellectuals so formidable. And here again, we find our clearest illustration in the 18th century. On the 1st of May, 1776, an elaborate criminal conspiracy was organized by a diseased degenerate named Adam Weishaupt, who was professor of law, canon law, mind you, in the University of Ingolstadt. The conspiracy was a secret society whose members were known as the Perfectibilisten, although they are also called Illuminati, a term that we may use so long as we may remember that it was also applied to other groups. Weishaupt's conspiracy is the one about which we know a great deal, because in 1786, the Bavarian government raided one of the local headquarters, seized the files, and published them. Volumes of this publication are now rare, but there are several copies in North America, including one in the Library of Congress. The purpose of Weishaupt's conspiracy, as explicitly stated by himself in writing and accepted by his fellows in the inner circle of the organization, was quite simply conquest of the world by the destruction of civilization, including specifically in its program such items as the abolition of private property, the abolition of national governments, the abolition of all morality, and the abolition of Christianity, and indeed of all religion. Weishaupt's organization, however, was modeled on the old order of assassins. By the way, the order of assassins was modeled on the earlier order of the Battini, so that you can trace this procedure back at least to the 9th century. You know, the order of assassins gave to our language that significant word. It, and of course Weishaupt's Illuminati in imitation, was divided into grades or degrees of initiation. All members were bound by stringent oaths and threats of death to both secrecy and blind obedience to all orders that came to them from above. But each grade or degree had its own doctrine. The real purpose of the order was concealed completely from the neophytes and revealed only to those who had ascended through the preparatory degrees to the inner circle. And promotion from one degree to another was, of course, available only to those who evinced the capacity for progressing at least a stage or two toward the insane nihilism of the inner circle. The rest were kept in lower grades proportionate to their capacities. As Weishaupt wrote to one of his colleagues, urging more intensive recruiting of neophytes, "These good people swell our numbers and fill our money box. Set yourselves to work. These gentlemen must be made to nibble at the bait. But this sort of people must always be made to believe that the grade they have reached is the last." Thus it was that a conspiracy for the destruction of all European nations was able to enlist among its members some of the reigning princes of Germany. And a conspiracy for the abolition of Christianity was able to enlist Christian theologians. The latter Weishaupt regarded as the best joke of all. He wrote, "The most wonderful thing of all is that the distinguished Lutheran and Calvinist theologians who belong to our order really believe that they see in it the true and genuine mind of the Christian religion. Is there anything you cannot make men believe?" The Bavarian branch of the Illuminati was suppressed, at least temporarily, in 1786. But the Bavarian government naturally could do nothing about the branches in other countries, and these preserved their secrets intact. I am not here concerned with any of the attempts that have been made to sketch the later history of the conspiracy. I'm interested only in the ascertained facts attested by published documents, and in these primarily as an illustration of phenomena that we may expect to find repeated many times in our own society. Weishaupt's Illuminati provide us with a perfect working model of conspiratorial activity among intellectuals. They show how easy it is for adroit criminals to enlist and manipulate educated suckers. And above all, bring us face to face with the highly distasteful fact that mankind does produce creatures like Weishaupt and his confederates in the inner circle. All of these are important points. Each would require detailed examination. In the activities of our intellectuals, we see time after time clear indications of conspiratorial cohesiveness and a coordination of efforts that strongly suggests conspiratorial, that is to say, central direction. If, for example, you examine the carefully documented publication of the Veritas Foundation, Keynes at Harvard, you cannot escape the author's conclusion that, I quote, "Keynesism is not an economic theory. It is a weapon of political conspiracy." And you cannot fail to see that the authors are certainly right when they say that the Fabian socialists have used the conspiratorial techniques of the Communist Party with the obvious intention of destroying the American Constitution. Now, without attempting at this time to decide whether the Fabian socialists are a subsidiary of the communist conspiracy or an independent group that happens to be working for virtually the same ends, we must note the important point that it operates as a conspiracy and ask ourselves whether this coordination of effort can be adequately explained in terms of some blind instinct, such as that which sets a colony of termites to work in harmonious cooperation for the destruction of a house, or whether it presupposes conscious direction from day to day. That is an important question, for we see the same kind of phenomenon, less obvious perhaps, but distinctly perceptible in almost all areas of activity. The intellectuals are influential not as individuals, but as gangs operating for the same general ends, usually with a high degree of coordination. And this coordination becomes really remarkable when you observe it in matters that do not affect a obvious common interest. Under modern conditions, for example, since the country has been covered with this film of public schools, it may be only natural for a swarm of so-called educators to cooperate perfectly in hunting down their common prey, the taxpayers, and to attack viciously anyone who disturbs them as they sink their proboscises deeper and deeper year after year. There is obviously a common interest. But now, what conceivable common interest could they have had in abolishing the House Committee on Un-American Activities? What envisaged profit could inspire a statewide gang to turn like a wolf pack on a superintendent of schools who sponsored a speaker who spoke unkindly of the communist conspiracy? Why should one of these packs, as happened in Wisconsin last year, turn on a professor of education, yes, of education, mind you, and hunt him out of the academic world because he spoke respectfully of the American Constitution and had dared to suggest the teachers of American history really ought to read it sometime? You see, how could that man's view, how could his opinion, how could his public statement have diminished the educator's collective annual take from the exploited and enslaved taxpayers of Wisconsin? You must assume some other motivating force beyond any perceptible immediate financial interest to the persons involved. Now that's why I fear that the intellectual shysters are too well organized, and that in the many branches which they work, whether they all know it or not, they behave as tentacles of a single octopus, and are therefore subject to a single central control. And in any case, you can't hope to educate the shysters. They already know what they are doing. At the very least, they know that they are witch doctors living by their wits and battening on the credulity of the American people. But, to return to the question with which we started, can liberals be educated? What about the intellectual suckers, the literate and well-meaning dopes like Professor Chalet and Madame D'Urfey and the rest? Can they be educated? Is there anything that we can teach them from books or show them by reason and argument to make them less fatally gullible? Or, if that cannot be done, are they at least intelligent enough to learn from experience when they see that they have been hoaxed? Some, no doubt. There have been several recent books by John Dos Passos and Edmund Wilson, for example, by honest liberal intellectuals who give most encouraging indications that they are beginning to grow up now that they are past 60 or 70. But the proportion, I'm afraid, is small. I do wish that one of those busybodies who are forever making statistical studies would make a statistical study that would mean something, a statistical study of the capacity of intellectuals to learn the obvious. There is an abundant material for dozens of studies of that kind, but here is just one example of what could be determined with some mathematical precision, and by the expenditure of much less effort and of much less money than goes into some learned university studies. For example, the research conducted 2 years ago by a leading university to determine whether the size of pancake preferred by men differs from the size of pancake preferred by women. As we all know now, the international communist conspiracy, coordinating the efforts of its divisional headquarters in New York, Washington, and Moscow, used your money to install in Cuba in January 1959 a notorious communist agent named Fidel Castro, and started to work immediately to install military and naval bases, including submarine pens and ballistic missiles, 90 miles from our shores. Of course, the conspiracy, through its various outlets, such as the New York Times and other lie papers, poured out hogwash about agrarian reformers, the George Washington of Cuba. And it was only to be expected that our intellectuals, who had swallowed exactly the same swill a few years before when the United States delivered China to the communist conspiracy, would lap it up again with relish. I'm not complaining about that. It's true that there was no possible doubt about the fact that Castro was a communist agent carrying out a communist operation. In a speech which some of you may have heard, it takes me a full hour to give a condensed resume of the evidence that was available to everyone before 1959, all of it on the public record and some of it in the files of every large newspaper, which proved beyond all peradventure of doubt that Castro and all of his real lieutenants were Bolsheviks. But I'm not going to say that our liberals should have looked at the evidence. As we all know, intellectuals are equipped with oversized brains that perpetually fizz with social ideals. So So perhaps it really would not be fair to expect them to find out what they are talking about. As soon as Castro came to power in Cuba, Mr. Robert Welch and Dr. J.B. Matthews in the pages of American Opinion, if you will pardon me for mentioning it, I, in speeches before the Daughters of the American Revolution, the Congress of Freedom, and other organizations, pointed out the obvious facts about Castro and the Soviet takeover of Cuba. You may remember how the liberal intellectuals began to shriek and spit at us. But I'm not complaining about that. We all know that intellectuals have mighty minds, capable of remembering the phrases that the communists teach them. So whenever they are disturbed by facts, they naturally start shrieking, "Reactionary, fascist, right-wing extremist, racist," and the like. And one shouldn't mind their spitting, really. After all, cats do that, you know. And for that matter, benevolent nature has equipped another puny creature, the polecat, with a means of making itself important in the world. So we should not be so extravagant as to suggest that our intellectuals could have learned the obvious in 1958 or 1959 or 1960 or most of 1961. Although, of course, the evidence not only about Castro but about the Soviet installation of missiles and other weapons aimed at the United States accumulated day by day. Probably big minds shouldn't be bothered with evidence. But here is a point that is worth considering. During the summer and autumn of 1961, the communist subsidiary called Fair Play for Cuba, which of course had been thoroughly exposed as a communist front for that time, sent up smoke screens for Comrade Fidel on a national scale, using of course a great many liberal intellectuals in the faculties of our colleges and universities. Those persons went on record publicly as endorsing Castro, guaranteeing that he was a sweet and lovely Democrat and social reformer, and even demanding in some cases that he be given his own pipeline direct into the Treasury in Washington. As I say, these people went on record publicly, signing manifestos and inserting full-page advertisements in newspapers. In some universities, as many as 300 individuals connected with a faculty or administration went on record in that way. The total throughout the country must be thousands. Now, undoubtedly, the organizers of those manifestos and some of the signers knew very well what they were doing. They just said to one another, "We've got to keep those American boobs quiet until the Soviet bases are all completed. And as soon as that is done, we'll say, oops, there's communists in Cuba after all. And we'll run out and scare the boobs by yelling, atomic holocaust, annihilation of mankind, negotiated peace, better end than dead." That was, of course, obviously planned by the organizers. But it's only charitable to suppose the majority of the signers of those manifestos were just intellectual suckers who actually believed the tripe to which they affixed their names. Now, as you may remember, in December 1961, sweet Fidel made monkeys out of those supermen by going on the radio and boasting that he had been a Bolshevik ever since he was a boy. At that point, the suckers must have realized that they had been had. The whole list of signers stood exposed before the American public, including their own colleagues and the residents of the communities in which their diploma mills were located, stood exposed as either traitors or jackasses. And I don't see how they could have failed to feel a teeny whit embarrassed, at least. When a normally intelligent human being has been swindled, he sits down and reviews very carefully the sources of information on which he relied, the weaknesses in himself, and the tricks of the confidence man who took him in. And he tries to make sure that he will not be caught again in the same way. That's what ordinarily intelligent and prudent people do. And I should think that it is not too much to expect of intellectuals. But it is a curious and perhaps significant fact that, so far as I have been able to learn, not one peep was heard from all of those thousands of super brains the day after Castro made his announcement, or the week after, or the month after, or the year after, or down to the present time. Now, it is possible, of course, that the poor suckers were so embarrassed that they kept quiet in the hope that their friends and neighbors would charitably forget their humiliation and disgrace. And I certainly would not be so cruel as to wish to remind them of that past. But what I should like to see is some investigator make a sociological study. All you would have to do is compile the names, which, as I have said, are all on record in print, and then ascertain how many of the signers are still out communist fronting and whooping it up for unmistakable communist apparitions such as disarmament or civil riots in the race war that is now being waged against white Americans. Until such a statistical investigation has been made, it would be a little venturesome to guess what percentage of liberal intellectuals are intelligent enough to learn from their own experience. And certainly those who cannot learn in that way could never be educated in any other way. Without statistics, any opinion that may be offered must necessarily be a mere guess. And I certainly don't want to seem discouraging, ladies and gentlemen, but my guess, my best guess for what it may be worth, is that among honest intellectuals, the percentage of recovery is comparatively small. They may mean well, but like confirmed alcoholics, they have acquired the habit of escape from reality into the wonderland behind the looking glass. If candid, they would have to say of themselves what one of their idols, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, admitted to Boswell at an unguarded moment. I cannot tolerate the world as it is. I must live in a world of fantasies. Such habits, once acquired, are extremely hard to break. That is why I fear that many liberal intellectuals, like so many alcoholics, won't be able to get along without their hooch.